Yeehaw!
Yeehaw!
The Patriot.
Thou Patriot.
I am a patriot and I love my country.
Is this a good bit to do at the current time?
No, this is not.
I'm a patriot. I love my country, but I also love your country and I want it for myself.
Oh, a little bit of politics.
Oh,
I love my country and your country. Let's have some of yours.
And their country. But I don't love them.
What a time to be doing the movie The Patriot.
What do you mean, Adam? There's no meaning in what you've said. What do you mean?
I don't know. I don't read the news.
Shut up. Shut up.
Oh, my God, I hate the news. And I don't like what's going on in the world. Luckily, the film The Patriot was also unbothered by what really happened in the real world. And so it doesn't. This may as well be a giant fiction.
That's the best start you've ever made to a podcast. That was. Did you prepare that or did it just come up in your head?
Just came up. It just occurred.
Really? That was impulsive.
Yeah. I had the thought that the film The Patriot is in no way real. And then you said that. And then quick as a flash, I said, I thought that applies.
You really were quick as a flash.
Thanks. Hello and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast, the show in which we chat about the movies or films that we forgot we'd even seen in the first place. And who do I mean by we? Well, I mean me, the host, and I also mean my pal, Mr. Joe Devine. Here he is.
Hello.
There he goes. He's not quick as a flash. He'll interrupt.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But when he's cued, when he's when he's cued.
Oh yeah.
He won't. This is.
I'm really happy to be here. I'm very excited about this episode.
Because
I'm a patriot.
And so on today's episode, we are doing the 2000 Roland Emmerich, The Patriot.
I believe that's Roland M. Rish. Isn't it? M is the middle initial.
Yeah, M-er-ish.
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 Yeah, and that's because M-er was unavailable, so M-er-ish took the job.
Of course, he's mostly known for directing Independence Day, which, on reflection, I'd love to do on this podcast.
We could as well, because I think that's a forget you forgot right there. I think it's. Do you know? I've got this thought. Let me see if you agree with this now, because it's not. I can't slot this in later.
Yeah. What's the thought?
If I'm jumping ahead on your game with this thought,
yeah,
I'll be very surprised. Has Will Smith? You were drinking and you nearly spat that out.
That's what I was going to theme all my pitches for later.
Around Will Smith.
Not even
really?
Joking. Yeah.
Oh, in which case shall I pause? No.
Finish the thought.
Here's my thought. Has Will Smith decanonized some of his own films through his later actions? I wonder, you know, because Independence Day for a long time, that was a movie that people sort of talked about sometimes, and they made a sequel not that long ago. But when Will Smith slapped the other man, whose name I can't even remember who it was now. Who did he slap?
I like the way you phrased that question. When Will Smith slap that other man? I don't know. When will he? Maybe tomorrow. Or when he says something about the other man's wife.
Smith is such an unpleasant guy. He's always. When will he do that?
Chris Rock.
It was Chris Rock. That's absolutely right. Now,
but listen, Joe, you've asked a great question. Listeners, hold on for the end of this episode where we will revisit this very question.
I can't wait for more Will Smith references throughout the episode. I'm really looking forward to those. Please continue.
So we're doing The Patriot, starring Mel Gibson, Jolie Richardson, Jason Isaacs, Heath Ledger, of course, Chris Cooper, Tom Wilkinson, Chechikaro. He's always the given baddie, the Euro baddie in a lot of movies. Not here. It's 165 mins.
Oh, not now, a minute too long. Oh.
Yeah. Well,
Well,
I would usually say Christ alive, this is far, far, far too long. As it is, I'll say it's a bit too long.
A little truncated.
Yeah, you could snip some out of this. But Big you Mel. Think it's bang on.
Big Mel.
You think it's bang on?
All I feel I need to say to that statement is Big Mel.
Right. I was expecting to be just drowning in a bog of, like, just like, oh God. Right. I can't believe I'm watching this for 165 mins. I didn't feel that way.
No, it's not that boggy. It's sort of like two films, isn't it? There's one film, which is up until the point where Big Mel's middle son, first dies, and he decides, you know, that's the inciting incident, right? Which is about 50 minutes into the film. And I think, well, that's a nice sort of film. That was actually very well structured, quite a fun short story sort of vibe. And then there's the film, at which point there's an hour and 46 minutes left, and that's the film, you know? So it's sort of like the preface and then the film. And I'm into that. I'm into that vibe. I like it a lot.
And so here's to the Letterboxd. Now, this whole next bit is all written in caps.
Really?
And I mean, Adam Buxton does this a lot, so maybe I can't do it. I'd like to evoke that somehow this is written in caps. Maybe I'll do should I do an American accent? I'll do an American accent.
I think you can do what you like. I don't think Adam Buxton invented speaking caps.
He did.
He's very funny. He's very, very funny and very good at it. But I don't think that's an original Adam Buxton joke. I think people have been speaking caps for as long as computers have been around.
But he shouted them, and he popularized the YouTube comments and shouting. If he'd written in caps, he'd shout it and
maybe in like a relatively niche UK market, but definitely not worldwide.
But everyone knows that I would have heard that, and then they think anyone who knows that would then know how derivative.
So you're more concerned with covering up your steps than you are.
Well, no, I know I'm derivative. Actually, so maybe it doesn't matter. Anyway,
I think everyone listening knows that we're both derivative. I think that's okay.
Before they were soldiers, they were family. Before they were legends, they were heroes. Before there was a nation, there was a fight for freedom. So that's all in caps. That's all in caps. That's a long tag God. In caps. After proving himself on the field of battle in the French
just,
and Indian...
Just to check. Now we're not in caps anymore. Just the ordinary at the beginning of a new sentence when someone's named. Okay,
got it. Mm-hmm. After proving himself on the field of battle in the French and Indian War, you don't see that in this movie. I don't know why this is belonging in a letterbox.
Proving himself a psycho by the sounds of it.
Benjamin Martin, played by Mel Gibson, wants nothing more to do with such things, preferring the simple life of a farmer. Now, if you changed the names, that's just the first, that's the Unforgiven. You got the start of Unforgiven there. Yep. But when his son, Gabriel, enlists in... Gabriel, that's played by Heath Ledger, in a breakout performance, a star-breaking performance for Heath, enlists in the army to defend their new nation. At no point... I don't know when... When is this film set? Hard to say.
But
the letterboxed, which should tell me, it doesn't say...
They assume everyone knows when the Declaration of Independence occurred.
But when his son Gabriel enlists in the army to defend the new nation, America, against the British, those bloody redcoats, Benjamin reluctantly, it happens in about 5 seconds.
That's true.
Reluctantly returns to his old life to protect his son. Oh, mate, that's just a really rubbish letterboxed.
Oh, dear. Would you like me to read the IMDb to you?
Yeah, let's get that.
Peaceful farmer Benjamin Martin is driven to lead the colonial militia during the American Revolution when a sadistic British officer murders his son.
It's like 1769.
Well, I think 1776 or something is the...
It's a 17-something, yeah.
Well, it's written here is during the American Revolution.
Yeah, but for our listeners... I don't know when that was.
I think it's 1776. Is the year of American Declaration of Independence. I think this film is set in the, you know, 1 or 2 years leading up to it, and the timeline is sometimes a little bit sort of vague, isn't it? Because at times months pass very, very quickly It's not always clear what's happening. So I think it's a good chance this is set over a couple of years. In fact, I think the film opens with a date, which is 2 years before the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, it says the date and it says where it's set. But I'm saying, like, at the minute, we haven't shared that. I wouldn't know if you just said, oh, this is the Declaration of Independence. I don't know when that is.
Why do you need to know? You know what the American Revolution is, right?
No.
You don't know what the American Revolution is?
Well, sort of like, you know, they just like split off from the British and no taxation without representation.
Got it. Let me ask you a different
question. The broad strokes of that kind of gubbins.
Hold on. Here's the important question, okay? In your head, when I say American Revolution, do you know what, do you sort of have an idea of what kind of hats they're wearing?
I know they've got muskets.
There you go. That's all you need to know for a movie. You don't need to know the date. You just need to know what hats they're wearing and that they've got muskets, and that's enough for a timeline.
What's interesting, what both of these blurbs, and they are blurbs, let's be honest, don't add, because at the time, this was kind of pertaining to be a, oh, this is sort of what happened, you know.
A bit like Braveheart.
This is based on things that happened.
Yeah.
You're thinking Mel's playing a guy who really existed. This guy, Benjamin Martin, never existed.
Oh, I didn't think that.
None of this stuff. Well, he's been the Scotch guy, right? Yeah. And so now he's in a film of a very similar
vibe. Right. So you're saying because William Wallace was a real character, although fictionally portrayed,
yeah,
that the assumption would be that Benjamin Martin in The Patriot, Braveheart's spiritual follow-up, would also be a real character.
I think so, and I think the audience enter that cinema with that thought, and I think the filmmakers, they were not that eager to say, oh, don't worry, this is all made up, because they are, you know, they're telling a historical story based on historical fact, and then they kind of
with some real characters, so like General Cornwallis, for example, that he's a real person from history.
He's a real person, and then by all accounts, this is a lot of historical hogwash going on, you know.
Well, yeah, we know, don't we, how Big Mel likes to rewrite history.
I mean.
And make it more interesting than it was, just to clarify.
It's not that it's more... He doesn't make it more interesting. They take huge liberties with the retelling of it. Like, I mean, for example, let's talk, you know, the slavery question.
Uh-huh.
They're very at pains to picture the American heroes as on the side of free men and black slaves.
Sure.
You know, Big Mel, he plays one of these Southern guys.
Yes.
The South at that time wanted to protect their slaveholding rights.
There's a scene where the British arrive, they're about to set fire to Big Mel's house, they're about to kill his son. He's tried to stay neutral in the war, so he's welcomed them, and he's also healing some of their wounded alongside the wounded of the colonial forces as well. Anyway, Jason Isaacs and the big bad British, they arrive, and they start to gather up the black people who are working on Benjamin Martin's farm. And Jason Isaacs says, you know, reads a notice that says, oh, by the way, all slaves, if they come and work for the British Army and serve in the army, they'll be freed after X period of time. And the film is at great pains to point out that the black people who work on Benjamin Martin's farm, they are already free people. They're not slaves, because Big Mel, Benjamin Martin, all of our good guys, they wouldn't be racist. Obviously, they're not racist. They believe that all men are created equal, as they say in the film. Even the French guy who shows up, he loves the African Americans. They're all loving each other. I did write down a line in my review. It says, it does have a very 90s liberal approach to race politics, which I think is unforgivable on rewatch, but understandable for when the film was made. I think the thing that is difficult about it is that there's such a cavalier approach taken to it, the only purpose being to make sure that the audience like this main character, and that's kind of offensive, really.
A long time ago, I was in Burma. My friends and I were working for the local government. They were trying to buy the loyalty of tribal leaders by bribing them with precious stones. But their caravans were being raided in a forest north of Rangoon by a bandit. So we went looking for the stones. But in 6 months, we never met anyone who traded with him. One day, I saw a child playing with a ruby the size of a tangerine. The bandit had been throwing them away.
So why steal it?
Well, because he thought it was good sport, because some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world.
I feel like we should take a step back for a minute, because what we've done, we've zoned in straight away on the things that are definitely not great about the film. And now, when I was saying before about the runtime, obviously it's very, very long. I think there's chunks that could be cut out. And there are things that I don't like about the film. On the whole, though, for a film like this, this type of film, I actually think it's very, very watchable. And there are some good things. One of them is something that you just mentioned, which is, I don't know, it's something slightly more mature than a code of honour. I wrote down here that I think while it is kind of amusingly stereotypical or stereotypically done in the film, I do think that giving Tom Wilkinson, who plays General Cornwallis, who's the like ultimate leader on the continent of the British, and he's the ranking officer in charge of the main evil bad guy, Jason Isaacs. Giving his character more of a distinct identity and interweaving the notion of old world structures and class and gentleman officers and all of these themes that come up, and then pitting it against the ideas of a new world of pragmatism and equality and liberty. This is just a lot more than most films like this do. And it's not fantastic, it's not brilliant, but it's good filmmaking. There are, like, at the very least, there are, however two-dimensional, there are clear values that sit behind these two opposing armies that make sense within the film and aren't completely insane when, like, reflected against reality. That's something interesting enough that probably doesn't, like, usually show up in a film like this.
Yeah, and there is quite interesting stuff as well about the old way of fighting. There's a very early battle, yeah. And Big Mel is looking on the field with his son Heath, and he's going, oh God, why is he doing it? Like, they've obviously fought in this really dumb way where you've just got rows and rows of guys with muskets. And it's like a walking war, and one side would fire and people would fall, and then whilst they're reloading, then the opponents would then fire back.
And it's all wrapped up in honour and gentlemanliness, and you don't run and you be brave, and it's absolutely insane.
And then so it's like all this fun notion of militia, and what Big Mel then goes to do is, well, we can kind of create, let's fight a different
kind of war.
Hide
behind a rock.
Yeah, let's hide behind a rock. I'm going to get out my old hatchet that I earned. This film is, and I want to say this out loud, this film is the last of the Melhicans, right? But with a little splash of Braveheart.
Sure.
And it's the last
of the Mel Bravehearts.
Yeah, because, and that's all I've got to say about that. The fact that it's historically inaccurate kind of doesn't matter, because you're watching this Hollywood myth-making in action.
Yeah.
It could have been, it could have not been so needlessly, forgetful of facts.
Sure.
But the thing that I liked about it that it didn't need to do, which Big Mel doesn't get enough credit for, is his sense of humour. The film starts with him making a chair,
mm-hmm.
and then sitting in a chair and it breaking.
A rocking chair.
A rocking chair. And then yeah. him throwing the chair on another pile of broken chairs.
It's worth saying just to add into this some extra context as well, that like this I think is painting him as a founding father type character, because you know George Washington was an inventor, Benjamin Franklin was an inventor and invented loads of things. So like the idea that he has seen a rocking chair before and he's trying to work out how to reverse engineer it without it's creating this idea of the type of character that he would be around about that time, like a Renaissance American man, and it's achieving that as well as achieving what you're saying.
Yeah, and but then it cuts to him throwing this chair that's broken onto another pile of maybe 10 other chairs, which is kind of the cutaway that you'd get in a Hot Shots movie as a joke, which I thought is a very interesting tone to start a movie with. But then later on, when he meets, maybe, what is it, like an hour and a half into the movie, he meets Cornwallis, and he's going to finally meet the head honcho of the British Army. And Big Mel goes into the office, and there's a rocking chair. And he goes to sit, he sits down and he looks at it. It's like, this film doesn't need to do this.
No. Also, it's so funny, I remember it viscerally. Like, I haven't seen this film for 15 years, but when the scene follows, there's a cut to General Cornwallis walking into the room, and Big Mel has the chair almost on its side and his head like touching the floor, looking up underneath it to try to understand it. The way he pops up, it's fantastic physical comedy. It's a brilliant moment that I've remembered 15 years later.
And Big Mel, this is a film where a man gets his face caved in by a cannonball and men get their legs swept out from under them by a cannonball. Yeah. And then they've also got these little odd moments of Big Mel humour.
Yeah. Big Mel goes to town on a guy's, the back of a guy's head with an axe, you know, just after his son has died, to the extent where he is covered in blood afterwards. And then 5 minutes later, he's trying to work out how the rocking chair goes back. But it works. It works. That's why I think the film needs to be so long. Because if it's 90 minutes long, you can't have these two things together.
And then, but then it touches on, after that scene where he's gone to town on that guy's head, Big Mel isn't like, he doesn't just like slowly decide to fight. He sees his son get killed by the baddie and then instantly runs into the house, gets out two rifles, gives them to his 12-year-old son and 14-year-old son.
I think probably younger. They play younger, don't they? 10 and 8 maybe?
It's a great sequence.
It's a really great sequence.
Yeah. It's probably the pinnacle of the movie.
Aim small, miss small. Aim small, miss small. Again, fantastic script writing.
Yeah, and they run out and to catch up with the baddie Brits, and he goes to town on these fuckers. And then later on, he takes his sons back, and one of them won't even look at him because he's 8 years old and he's just had to kill a man. After that, the film never really returns to that relationship.
No.
And it's like, this is 165 minutes. I feel like I want you to...
Instead, it picks a different child to be his kind of heartstring pulling for the rest of the film. That is a little unusual, for sure.
Susan. She's called Susan.
Her name's Susan.
Susan did actually almost make me cry watching this movie.
Susan did?
Yeah.
The child?
Susan the child.
Susan got to you. Wow.
Susan doesn't speak for the whole movie.
Yeah.
And then when Big Mel comes back very late in the day, she won't give him anything. She's like, fuck, I hate you.
Yeah.
You're just disappearing all the time. And then he's going to go again, back in for the final battle. And Mel's really good in this.
Papa!
Mel's
Papa!
Papa! Papa! Oh, mate, I really went. Because I imagined I was going off to fight.
You thought you were Big Mel, didn't you?
And my child couldn't bear to say goodbye, so ignored me. And then burst forth with, Papa, Papa.
Let me tell you, Big Mel, you just said Big Mel's really good in this film. Big Mel, when Big Heath dies in this film about, you know, actually not that far from the end, right? Big Mel's performance, it's actually phenomenal, Adam. A movie like this has no right to have this performance in it. It's absolutely fantastic. And that, I think that's why I like the film so much, because this film should be like a shit to fine film based on the script, based on the story, based on the type of thing it is, right? And yet, Big Mel takes it as seriously as if he's painting the Mona Lisa. I mean, the way that he chews the edge of his little fist when Heath dies, it's phenomenal. It's up there in the best sort of, I don't know, 25 honest, authentic parent reactions to deaths I've seen in a film. And this is why I think the film being so long and being set over a long period of time is to its benefit, because it doesn't require him to immediately move past this situation. And so Big Mel does something in a film that I think is very realistic. His son's just died. He goes mad. He's mental. He's like, doesn't know what to do with himself. He's like, he's losing emotional control in all sorts of chaotic ways that wouldn't be expected. It's not just crying. He's not just, he's not just angry. He's mad. And it's, and in an understated way, it's absolutely fantastic. I watch this and I think, Big Mel knows what he's doing. Now, I know Big Mel's got his problems. I'm only talking about Big Mel, the actor here. But it's so watchable. And it has, a film like this has absolutely no right to have that in it. And it's a surprise that it's there.
It's a loads better performance than Braveheart, which...
Well, it's because he's not doing a crazy Scottish accent.
Fight if you can, I. Run. You'll have to. At least a while. And dying in your bed, many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell her that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom?
As discussed, it's also tone deaf, but it's from the year 2000, you know. What are you going to do?
It does have a certain consistency in terms of the things it's trying to say. So Heath Ledger says to him, to his dad, listen, this is bigger than you. This is bigger than you. Don't try and get...
This is bigger than you.
Don't try and get revenge, or okay? Just what you got to do is we got to focus on getting those bloody Brits out, okay?
Yar.
And then Big Mel's like, oh, they killed my son. And then at the end, of course, Heath, he's livid. His wife gets burnt in a church.
Livid.
And what does he do? He doesn't live by his... like, oh, okay. And then Heath dies. And then Big Mel, again, second son dead. And again, it builds up to that moment in the big final battle.
Mm-hmm.
Even though these battles would not hinge on one man, this is a movie, so it's got to hinge on one
man. I just want to say, if Big Mel was in the middle of a historical battle for real, I think he's got enough charisma that it could the whole thing could turn on Big Mel's dime. You know what I mean?
Maybe, yeah, maybe. But he grabs a flag, and at some point, it's very late in the day for the film to kind of go, oh, by the way, it's quite important, whoever holds a flag.
Yeah.
And then he holds the flag, and he chooses the flag, the American flag, over his petty revenge, which then he also gets to get anyway as well, because, you know, he's chosen the right thing. So...
It's not a perfect movie, absolutely. Well done, everyone involved, I think. There is something, though... Isn't there? There's something a bit strange about this film, or at least I'm curious what you think about this, what your answer will be, because it's a choice the film makes to have Big Mel macking on his dead wife's sister, right? I mean, it doesn't need to be his dead wife's sister. When I was watching the film, I kept thinking, is something going to happen that helps me to understand why this character relation choice is necessary? Could she simply not be an old love interest pre his marriage, or someone that maybe left before the war or couldn't rekindle with, and then later met a new woman and had all these kids? Could she not have been a friendly neighbour that they lived next to? Or, I don't know, he knows everyone in the town. Why does he not just know her for some reason? Instead, the main love interest, which is a very... you know, secondary story and not really sort of main part of the film at all. But the love interest is his dead and departed wife's sister, who's very attractive. And of course, you know, Big Mel would be macking on her if this was everyone would be macking on this woman. But Why do you think the film's made that choice? Because it's quite unusual, isn't it? And it goes to absolute lengths to convince you in every other way that he's a fantastic, upstanding citizen. Except, you know, he wants to pop his hands in the honeypot.
This is what, again, the film doesn't need to be this nuanced. And you could argue it's nuanced. Initially, I was watching it thinking, he's not going to end up having it off with his sister. I'd forgotten.
He can't.
But I thought...
That's not allowed.
The reason why they've got this character there is because they want to show that he could still have sex if he wanted, but is choosing not to. Okay, his wife is dead. Yep. Big Mel has got another dead wife. My last dead wife was in Signs, or maybe that's in the future. Yeah, I've got dead wives coming out my ears.
Yeah. Signs is one year in the future, I think, yeah.
This is, and the frisson between them in a very early scene, you're like, oh, okay.
Sure.
Sister of a dead wife. And then, but then later on, it gives it that extra heft for the choice of like, I've got this dead wife.
Right.
And I need to have sex with someone else. And I really want to have sex with her with my dead wife's sister. And it makes the choice when he finally does that much richer. And it's got my favourite... I've WhatsApped this to you. This has got my favourite moment in all kinds of... It's not this specific moment, but it's my favourite kind of moment in all movies. It's when the patriarch of a family who's either got a divorced wife or a dead wife... they're always dead. And they finally kiss the other woman, whoever she is.
Yeah.
It's always in front of his children.
Always, yeah.
And the children have been, they've obviously been yearning for father to finally get his end away. And everyone's like the dad is always the last to realize he should be getting off with this other woman. And they smooch. And everyone always watches and everyone smirks, whether it be a six-year-old child all the way up to a teenager. And they all smirk and smile like, "Lol, this is what we wanted." And that's what happens in this movie. And I loved it. Oh, sorry, hang on. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, yes.
Hey, John, how's it going?
Hey, Dave, how's it? Yeah, no, fine, thanks. How's it going?
Pretty good. How was the holiday? Sorry I didn't get up there.
Yeah, no, it's okay. It's just, it's been really tough since the wife died, obviously, as you know. And it's been a bit lonely, but the kids have really rallied around me. And we had a lovely time, all told. I think we're really finally kind of coming together again as a family. And my dead wife's sister also came as well, so... It was quite nice.
Oh, Julie.
Julie really kind of came through on the present side.
Oh, what did Julie get?
Well, she got the kids, she kind of created this memorial to their dead mother. And it was just really heartfelt. And it was this really big cathartic moment where we could all say goodbye to my wife and her dead sister and their dead mum.
That sounds lovely.
And then we kind of ended up getting off with each other in a hot tub after we'd put the kids to bed.
Sorry, I thought you just said you got off with Julie. Is that?
Yeah, no, got off with, yeah, me and Julie, yeah, we got off with each other.
You got off with Julie? Anne's sister, Julie?
Yeah, but Anne's dead.
The aunt of your children?
Right, yeah, but they're really looking for a new mother figure. I mean, they basically look the same. They look the same. They've both got similar features. I think
Well, they're twins. I mean, they would look the same, wouldn't they?
Right, exactly. So it's a kind of a perfect... It's a win-win.
Do you not think that's maybe really unhealthy?
I'm just trying to think for the, like, low-hanging fruit, success-wise, like, what would be most or least... traumatic for them? Would it be someone who looks just like their mum, who's always been in their life, that I get off with? Or if I'm just alone forever and just focus right. my attentions on them, and then maybe like get off with someone who looks completely different from their mum? I think maybe the latter would be more traumatic.
I feel a bit like if you fancy her now, it sort of definitely presupposes that you did when Anne was alive as well, doesn't it? Because otherwise, it's not like people's tastes and stuff completely change. So doesn't that make it a bit weird? Like, don't you think that means that other people think well, now the wife's out of the way, he you know, he's going to do it with the sister. It feels a bit gross.
Do you think, oh, so they're going to think that I always wanted to have it off with Anne?
I mean, I don't think I've ever heard of this situation before where one twin dies and then the husband gets with the other twin. I mean, I just don't know.
They're not identical twins. Okay, I know you threw that in there, like that they're twins, but just for the nuance of it.
Right.
They do, they ultimately just look like sisters.
They look pretty similar to me. Put it this way, right? Like, do you remember the film The Patriot?
What, with Big Mel?
Yeah, with Big Mel, and then
yeah.
Jolie Richardson played Charlotte, who was the sister of Big Mel's dead wife. And you remember at the end of that film, they get off with each other, and you're sort of watching it and you're thinking, well, that's kind of confusing. I mean, it makes sense in the film, but do you think that means that when Big Mel's wife was alive, that he also fancied Big Mel's wife's sister then as well? Because it's not like, you know, if you fancy someone, you fancy someone, right? Like, your wife dying doesn't magically mean you fancy people that you didn't before. So it makes me think that that just means that Big Mel always fancied his wife's sister before his wife was even dead.
Yeah, but he's just human. I mean, I did too. It just doesn't... Because I married the first one, and I call her the first one, and now I'll call the second one the second one. I right. married the first one, and then that's the door closed for who else I have sex with. But then the first one died, and then that opens... The door's open. I mean, there is no such thing as love, okay? There's just, like, opportunity. This is why people end up having affairs with people at work. Or what? What are the odds that they just happen... You meet someone that you love at work? No, it's because you're at work. It's because it's the sister of your wife, okay? It's just proximity, okay? Let's all just forget all this nonsense that there's something special going on. There's not. It's just that happen you see someone every single day, and then you hang around long enough, and you're like suddenly going, yeah, I'll give this a go, and then you do. And then one of them dies, and then they die, and then you're like, well, who else is knocking around? The sister, and she obviously wants to see her nephews and nieces. And I'm not going to stop that. And then I'm obviously around, and then... It's breakfast, and, like, you know, you reach out for the croissant and you brush fingers, and then
before you know it,
it's bacon. Do you not? Why? What do you think love is?
I think, you know. I think you've won me round. I think love actually is all around, and so who's better?
Well, I'll be honest, I'm holding out for Judy.
Judy? The third sister?
Yeah, yeah, she's the eldest. But I'm not going to, like, do anything to Anne.
Anne's dead.
Anything off the trolley, dears?
Hey, did you like the when Mel, Big Mel, meets the other main French guy, Chechki Cairo?
Yeah.
The references to the French are quite fun. His first meeting with the French guy ends with Mel just going, oh, French. So the French come out. There's like a mixed feeling about the French in this movie. They came late. Can they be trusted? They're French.
Also, I love how the film paints the French as though they are like the heroes of liberty, when actually they're just having a war with England everywhere, and will take any. They're opportunistic. Another opportunistic empire.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, why are the French going to turn up? Well, because yeah, they just want to stick it to us Brits.
Yeah, it's funny how the French are perceived, isn't it? And I wonder often. Well, two things, I suppose. One, how differently are different nations, different major nations, perceived by other nations than England? So where am I sort of getting, you know, caught up in my English perspective on things? And secondly, because England and America have had such a vast cultural impact on the world, sometimes you would say that what people from England and America have thought historically might become more commonplace throughout the world because of that cultural impact, you know? So maybe once it was different and nowadays it could be one and the same. Because when I think about the French, I think, well, they like cheese. That's the first thing that comes to mind. If I were to do, you know, stereotypes of people, you say a country, I'll say the first thing that comes to mind about that country, and we'll explore what that means about me and my biases, okay?
Sorry, do you want to do this on our podcast?
Pick big ones.
China.
Rice. That's what I think of. Okay, that's food, right? Go again.
Russia.
Snow.
Austria.
Women. Because of culture. Because culture always said that Austria had the prettiest women, right? And when the soldiers from World War II all arrived in Austria when they were sacking Germany after the, you know, towards the end of the war, all the people came home and said, oh, the women of Austria, the mountain women of Austria were the best women. That's honest. There's my bias right there. Austrian women.
Germany?
Sausages.
Yeah.
Food.
I would have said that about Austria as well.
Right.
France?
Cheese. It has to be cheese.
Italy?
Weirdly, it's also cheese, but it's more salty cheese.
I mean, you say pasta, or is this game just like pasta. Say a country and say a food
say
stuff?
Cheese. I'm thinking now, like the further east and south you get in the Mediterranean, the more salty the cheese gets.
I say China, you say rice. I say France, you say cheese. I say Russia, you say no.
I said snow. I said
what? Because you don't know a fucking Russian food stuff.
No, I
say
snow,
vodka.
Not no.
Oh, I thought you said no.
I said snow.
I thought that you were refusing to speak about Russia in case you got cancelled by Putin. No, I'm not going to say a thing about Russia. Putin knows who I am. He's going to come and get me with another chop.
Now I've had a bit of time to think about it. Obviously, I think gulag. That's obviously the first thing that comes to mind when you say Russia. Let's play. I'm going to play the game with you, okay? Quickly. You ready? You got to answer as quick as possible, okay?
Okay, foods are banned.
One,
great.
Two, three. Canada.
Maple.
Maple syrup.
No,
just
leaf
any
is
maple.
Leaf.
Maple tree. That's maple isn't a thing. Maple is...
Okay, fine. Say...
Canada.
All right, then. Oh, yar.
That's not a thing. Fuck's sake.
I have to say a thing, do I?
Yeah, like
okay,
I
ice.
Said cheese.
Ice hockey.
Ice hockey. There you go. No, that's it. That's it.
Great.
That's it.
Okay. Ice hockey.
Ready?
Yeah.
Norway.
VPN.
When was the last time you heard from your father?
Daddy.
Hey, do you want to play a different game?
Yeah, one that you've pre-planned.
I've planned this game a little bit. I watched this film the other day and I thought, isn't it nice that Big Mel is Heath's dad in this film? Because it's like one sort of leading man actor handing the reins to another. Obviously, they're both Australian as well, so that's quite fun. And then I thought, well, actually, thinking about it off the top of my head, there are a couple of films where Big Mel plays father to an actor that went on to become very famous after that point. And I thought I'd give you the opportunity to play the game Guess Who Big Mel Fathered, with a bonus round towards the end. Okay, so if we've got Heath in there, to my mind, there are two more notable names that you could guess, one less so than the other, and also extra points for saying one of the other children in The Patriot. Maybe not his name, but another film that he's in. I'm curious if when you saw him, you made that connection. Okay, so off you go.
Well, what was always confusing about Signs was like, is Joaquin Phoenix Big Mel's son? And he's not.
Oh, he's not. He's the brother.
He's his idiot brother.
Oh, I forgot. He's one of my two names. I've messed that up, haven't I?
He's not.
Because you're right.
Such a confusing bit of casting, age-wise. Who else has Big Mel fathered? He doesn't have a kid in The Lethal Weapons. He's got a kid in Ransom, but that kid never came to nothing. He got kidnapped and then disappeared. He hasn't hugely fathered around, has he?
Well, he plays a father in The Beaver from 2011.
Oh, is it Anton Yelchin?
Yeah, I mean, obviously he's passed away now, Anton Yelchin, but he did play Anton Yelchin's father, and he was quite famous, I would say, at the point when he died.
He was great, fantastic. He's fantastic in Star Trek as well, the engineer guy. I don't know what's he called. Doesn't matter. He was fantastic. Really, real shame that he died so young.
Real shame. Well. One of the other kids in The Patriot is called Trevor Morgan, and it might help. I don't know if you noticed or recognised him from another film. As soon as I sat down and put this on, I went, oh my God, when I watched this last time, I didn't make this connection. But he's the kid in another quite famous film. In that film,
he's the kid in Sixth Sense.
No, not the kid in Sixth Sense.
Is he not?
I don't think so. Oh, he is the kid in Sixth Sense. You're absolutely
right. He's the horrible upstart kid in The Sixth Sense.
What I recognised him from, though, was a film just a year later. So here's the three films he does in a three-year period. The Sixth Sense in 1999, then The Patriot in the year 2000. In the year 2001, he's in this film where his father... is played by William H. Macy, and he's on a little island, and William H. Macy needs to go to the island to rescue him.
Oh, it's the right Jurassic Park 3.
He's the same kid as the kid from Jurassic Park 3.
Yeah.
He had a pretty good little career going, didn't he?
But that's what happens. That's what, you know, kid actors, they just disappear.
They just disappear. Know? It's sad,
just
isn't
it? Have it. It's just a different skill set.
It's just really sad.
That's what I tell my kid, you know, when she sort of sees other kids doing well in drama or like, it's like, don't worry about it.
Right.
Kid actors go nowhere.
Yeah.
It's completely different. It's a nothing skill. It's a complete happenstance of probably who their parents are. Harry Potter's parents, they were casting agents.
Right.
You know, it's a
Harry Potter's parents were James and Lily Potter, and they died in a horrible, horrible murder. I think you'll find. Did you mean Daniel Radcliffe's parents?
Danny Radcliffe's kids' parents. Danny
sorry.
Radcliffe.
Mate, I thought we were cross-speaking there.
Yeah.
Okay, you've done very, very well so far. Bonus round to clinch it for full points, maximum points. Can you name one famous actor who's played Big Mel's father?
James Garner.
I don't know if that's the answer, if that's an answer. Is it? When did he do that?
Oh, well, he was in Maverick with James Garner as Maverick, and I thought Garner played Maverick's dad. Maybe he doesn't play his dad. Who else plays his dad? I know. He plays the dad of Mark Wahlberg in Daddy's Home 2.
Does he? Yes, he does.
Yeah.
Yes. Another famous dad situation. Oh, my God, you're on fire.
That's a very famous dad. Who plays Big Mel's dad? I mean...
Well, who plays Big Mel's dad? Eh? Freedom.
Mike Myers.
Freedom. No, sorry. I'm doing Shrek. No.
Yes,
I'm deliberately doing a bad Scottish accent. To help you get...
Freedom! Right, oh, so it's that big Scotch... The big Scotch guy from... Game of Thrones, is he?
I'm pretty sure this is wrong anyway. It's not his dad.
It's
his uncle. Yeah, Brian Cox plays his uncle in Braveheart. My game's been quite bad, hasn't it? Because I would say two of the three names actually weren't the dad in either situation.
No.
Braveheart, the battle sequences of that are brutal consistently, and there's a lot of it. I think this movie's actually better than Braveheart.
I agree, by the way.
More rewatchable. But it doesn't have that consistent brutality to it. The whole muskets of it is also just really fucking boring.
Here's another thing I don't like about the film, but really this is just a criticism of all American films, that it sort of thinks stuff's cool, doesn't it? It thinks, the system's cool and stuff, whereas I don't think that. And the film sort of like does stuff from the perspective that it's all cool and things are good and stuff, but I actually don't think they are good and stuff, and I think the system's not good either. So yeah. I don't like it and stuff.
Why do you think Big Mel didn't direct this and Roland Emmerich did?
I don't know.
Off the back of Braveheart, I feel like Big Mel he's probably directing this off on the side, and he's saying, "Hey, Roland, you think you know how to? Do you want any advice how to shoot a battle sequence? I know how to shoot a battle sequence.
I've just
mate.
Done it. Yeah. Well, I've asked Colin because I don't know the answer, and Colin's very confident that he does know the answer. We know this can be an issue, but would you like to hear it anyway? Because he didn't want to, says Colin, and because the project wasn't really his in the way that Braveheart was. Here's a few clean reasons, Colin says. He was burned out on directing. Braveheart nearly broke him. He's talked about the physical and mental toll of directing, starring, and producing at that scale. After winning Best Director, he deliberately stepped back rather than chase a repeat. He didn't originate The Patriot, that's the second reason. It was developed elsewhere, and so he wasn't the driving creative force, which was a different dynamic to Braveheart. Emmerich was hired early, and he fit the studio brief. Columbia apparently wanted a large-scale, commercially reliable war epic. Emmerich had just come off Independence Day and Godzilla. From a studio point of view, that was safe hands, even if the tone ended up harsher than his reputation suggested. Gibson was already planning The Passion of the Christ, so by the late 90s he was privately gearing up for it. That film required years of focus and money, apparently, and directing The Patriot would have delayed or derailed that. And then also, final answer, he's always been a selective director, says Colin. He's never treated directing as a career ladder. Each film that he's directed has been something that he felt personally compelled to make, not a logical next step. Now, that's very convincing, isn't it? Almost as though it doesn't matter whether it's true or not, because I believe it completely, and I will never look up the real answer.
Yeah, no, that all tallies. He's very selective. It doesn't bang or bosh him out.
What has he done?
He's done Braveheart, he's done Apocalypto, and he's done Passion of the Christ.
Is it just those three?
I think so.
Let's have a quick look.
I think he's gearing up for Passion of the Christ 2.
What? The Return?
This time it's personal. The Return.
Jesus
yeah.
doesn't come back, does he? He can't, surely. Oh, wow. The Resurrection of Christ Part 1, The Resurrection of Christ Part 2. It's like Dune or Shay.
I mean, that movie made so much money.
So he's directed 10 things. There's The Man Without a Face.
Right, of course.
1993, The Man Without a Face, starring...
Mel Gibson.
Mel Gibson. Nick Stahl.
Don't worry who else is in it.
Oh.
Just skip on.
It was about a man without a face. Okay, skipping on. Mel Gibson then directed Braveheart. The Passion of the Christ came later in 2004. 2006 was Apocalypto, and then two other films since then. One that came out in 2025. Did you know the film Flight Risk was directed by Big Mel?
Yeah, starring Mickey Wahlberg.
Starring Mickey Wahlberg. And...
Yeah, what's before that, though?
Now, oh, this is quite fun, because this film is it's such a Big Mel film. Such a Big Mel film. Serving during the Battle of Okinawa, refuses to kill people, and becomes the first man in history to receive the Medal of Honor. Do you remember when they were sort of saying this is going to win?
Go over that hill.
Yeah. Oh my God. They were like, this is going to win Oscars and stuff.
I go Hacksaw up and Ridge. Down the hill. I climbed up that cliff 100 times and saved every man up there.
I remember watching that and thinking, this is fucking hideous. This is one of the most hideous films I've ever seen. This is the perfect film for Andrew Garfield to be in, you know? Andrew Garfield's character in Hacksaw Ridge is exactly what I think of Andrew Garfield, you know?
Poor Andrew Garfield.
I know, bless him. What some terrible choices, really.
Yeah, terrible choices. I don't like his vibe at all.
Is he the worst picker of projects, you know?
That Sky TV advert he's on is a particularly duff pick.
I love how Idris Elba completely gets away with it, but Andrew Garfield doesn't.
Because he put the way Garfield turns up in that ad, he doesn't have the wherewithal to look embarrassed.
Yep.
It looks like he's putting his all into it and he thinks it's funny and it's
big time.
Dross.
Big time. Okay.
You can see the shame in Idris's eyes when he's in
you
the
can,
advert.
I think you can.
And with Winston, even. Winston in a betting advert, you're like, yeah, mm-hmm. I get that, you know, I can see that you're actually really ashamed of this.
Okay, let's play a quick game.
No sense of shame in Garfield. Game?
Quick game. It's the Garfield choices game, okay? All that's going to happen, I'm not going to read all of them, but I'm going to read some movie choices to you, some movies he's in, and all you have to do is say, yes, that was a good choice, no, that was a bad choice, okay?
Yes.
Never Let Me Go.
Good choice.
The Social Network.
Good choice.
The Amazing Spider-Man.
Good choice.
The Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Bad choice.
Hacksaw Ridge.
Bad choice.
Yeah. Silence.
Bad choice.
Oh, I don't know. I think that's a good choice. Unfortunate outcome.
Yeah, because it's Scorsese. Fine. But he says do an Italian accent. Fine. Good choice. Good choice.
Okay. The Eyes of Tammy Faye.
That was quite well received, I think. So good choice.
Okay. Tick, Tick, Boom.
Oh, very good choice.
Okay, Spider-Man No Way Home. That's a good choice. You've got to, that doesn't even count as a choice. Obviously, there's not a choice. You have to come back and do
good
that.
Choice.
We Live in Time.
Bad. Not seen it. Bad
I'm
choice.
I'm going to say, but I don't know. There's something felt a little cynical about that one, didn't it? After the Hunt.
I mean, it's got Julia Roberts in. It's got directed by Luca Guadagnino. You
is it
would
really?
Say that's a good choice.
Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Your buddy Luca.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, and then finally, not out yet, The Magic Faraway Tree.
Oh, bad choice.
Bad choice. Okay. So it's not that bad then, because of the big films on here, seven good choices, five bad choices. What's that like for a strike rate, do you think? Obviously not up against like Big George, because George is only picking good stuff, but
it's just not good enough.
Let's pick another actor and see what the strike rate is with another actor, though, right? Because I feel like that's not bad. More good than bad is. Let me pick another actor.
But of the same.
I'm going to try and pick one of the same sort of. I mean, who is there? How old is he? Wow, he's the same age as Henry Cavill and Chris Hemsworth and Adam Driver and Jesse Eisenberg and Jonah Hill and Emily Blunt and Donald Glover and Domhnall Gleeson.
Adam Driver's a good. Good shout to say.
You've said that because you know that he does more good choices than bad choices. You're trying to sway the game in your favour here.
No, because he's in Silence as well. So we've got crossover.
That's
and
true.
He's American.
Okay, let's do Adam Driver. Now, we obviously know that he makes probably more good choices than bad. He makes some bad choices.
I think he does make. I think it's up in the air. I think it's up in the
he's
air.
He's in way more films.
Okay.
Ready?
Yep.
J. Edgar.
Bad choice.
Okay. Can you count bad choices and I'll count good choices? Francis Ha.
Good choice.
Good choice. Lincoln.
Good choice.
Inside Llewyn Davis.
Good choice.
Good choice. It's not about being in it a lot. It's about good choices, you know? There's just the problem with this game is there's a bunch of films here I don't know. Tracks.
Never heard of
what
it.
What If?
Don't know.
Hungry Hearts.
What If what?
While We're Young.
These are all bad. These are all bad choices because they disappear.
Know. You've heard of While We're Young, right? I feel like that's got Ben Stiller in it, hasn't it? Isn't that a Ben Stiller project?
But yeah, bad choice.
All right, so you've counted
all
four
bad
of those,
choices.
Yeah?
Four, yeah.
This
one,
is where
two,
I leave
three,
you.
What, from the podcast?
Midnight Special.
Good choice.
Okay. Patterson.
Good choice.
Silence.
Good choice.
Star Wars The Force Awakens.
Good choice.
I agree with that. People won't like that, but I agree with that. The Meyerowitz Stories.
Good choice.
Logan Lucky. I think it's a good choice.
Bad outcome.
Okay, I'm not doing any more Star Wars because that's just one choice. Black Klansman. I think that's a good choice.
That's a good It's a good choice.
I think that's a good film. And at some point we should do that on the podcast because I know it hasn't retained its position in culture. And wow, it came out 8 years ago. That's horrifying. The Man Who Killed Don Quixote.
Bad choice.
Yeah, you got it. The Report. That's the one where he's like doing like a sort of Ed Snowden type thing, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's a good movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Dead Don't Die.
Bad choice.
Bad choice, absolutely. Marriage Story.
Good choice.
Okay. Annette.
Bad choice.
The Last Duel.
Good choice.
House of Gucci.
Bad choice.
White Noise.
Bad choice.
65.
Bad choice.
Ferrari.
Bad choice.
Megalopolis.
Bad choice.
Father, mother, sister, brother.
Never heard of it.
Okay. Well, he's rumoured to be in the pre-production of Heat 2.
Good choice.
Okay.
14 bad choices.
Only 13 good choices. So actually, his hit rate is much worse than Andrew Garfield.
Mm.
Interesting.
Interesting.
He just does a lot more films. Although, I'll be honest, I didn't read out all of the films that Andrew Garfield did, so probably would be quite similar. If anything, that kind of renders the whole game pretty pointless.
For too long I've been parched of thirst, unable to quench it. Too long I've been starving to death and haven't died. I feel nothing. Not the wind on my face, nor the spray of the sea. You best start believing in ghost stories, Miss Turner. You're in one.
Should we play the box office game?
I'd love to play the box office game. What about you?
Let's get busy living.
Did you watch Train Dreams yet?
No, I haven't had time.
Shame. It's a shame. I was just looking at the Discord to see if there was anything I needed to respond to, but a lot of nice chat in there, though. Be good if people got in there, wouldn't it? If they weren't in there already, they got in there.
Yeah, join the Discord. We did a live Discord in December, and we're going to do another one right in March.
Well, I mean, I think we could do it almost any time, to be honest.
Well, I mean, we should tell people to look forward to something, right? We should pencil something in, so
we should.
They can pop it in the old diary. Yeah,
we should, but
give them something to look forward to.
Well, yeah, you think?
You said March. Now, do you think earlier?
Didn't actually say March. I just said like March would be good, and then you sort of like you got kind of like stuck on March, and then once you said it to me between now and since then, and I was like, I'll just say yeah, you know.
What's like March if not March?
February and April are like March.
No, they're not.
You don't think so?
Well, like, I mean, June's like March in that it's a month.
That's true. That's also true. Yeah,
right.
In a different way, that's true. If only March were like March, then there wouldn't ever be any point saying like, would there? You'd just say March.
I just thought you were just like, you know, like saying like, you know, like the way that young people say like, when they just throw it in there when it doesn't mean anything.
Right.
If you meant around March, you would have said around March.
I wouldn't have. I would have said something like March or something, you know, around then, like.
You're the decider of such things because you know when we should do things. I don't know when we should do things.
Right.
You're Mr. Billy Big Balls. Say when we'll do it.
Well, now, see, there you go. What you've said there is the key difference, isn't it? I don't know when we should do things. I simply say when we should do them, and you believe me. What I have that you don't is a great sense of confident authority. And you're a big bag of uncertainty, aren't you? You're just looking around for another person to tell you March. And then when they say it might not be March, it could be one of the other months either side of March, you go mad, like chaos has happened.
So, yeah, great. You've lasered in on the fact that I don't think anyone wants to come and listen to such a thing. And so right. I need to be able to deflect all
responsibility. Okay, listen to me. Take responsibility. If you're keen to do it again, let's do it sooner. You decide when. Say it now. Be authoritative. Say it now. What month? Say it.
March. No, February.
No,
February.
No, I said March. We're doing March. Budget brackets estimated for the movie The Patriot from the year 2000. Of course, it would have been being made the previous millennium, eh? 1999. What do you think they spent on movies like this back then?
A lot.
Yeah.
You know? This has got a lot of location work, a lot of hats, a lot of muskets.
Mm. The musket budget here, out of this world.
The ponytail budget.
Yeah.
Oof. So they're going to spend... Are they going to spend 100 on this? Is it too soon for that kind of money? Yeah, 100 mil. They're going to spend 100 mil.
110 mil. You're inside the 10%. Just inside. By a cent, my friend. By a cent. Okay, let's see. Can we keep this kind of performance rolling on? July the 2nd, the year 2000, opening weekend US and Canada. What do you think this movie is a-taking?
I mean, it's called The Patriot. It's coming out in slap bang in the middle, probably near some kind of Independence Day, from the director of Independence Day.
Well, July the 4th is Independence Day, and this film is coming out on July the 2nd. So it's coming out Independence Day weekend.
Yeah, like really maybe nearby, you know, whenever Independence Day is.
Yeah.
It's coming out nearby.
Yeah, 2 days away.
Yeah, if you say so.
No, I mean, I'm saying that, yeah.
Yeah, is that when it is?
That's what. That's when it is, yeah. July 4th.
July. So this is going to go down real smooth in the old American box office, I'd say.
Year after Braveheart. They loved that stuff, didn't they? Eat it up. Num, 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 num.
Let's do Logan territory, 70 mil.
No. Interestingly, it did do well, but it's inflation not considered. Lower than Jumper territory. It's 22.4 million dollars opening weekend. Maybe people are busy on July 4th, you know? Maybe that opening weekend, there's something about it where they're like, they're all at the fireworks or something instead, or they all went the following weekend. I don't know. If they did.
I mean, I'm floored.
You're floored.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm floored.
Well, let's move on to gross worldwide while you're on the floor, see if we can get you back under the table. Of course, you've got the 10x rule to support you here, should you choose to use it. But what do you think this movie took overall?
Maybe people were deterred by the old long runtime and not that fussed about it. And that damp opening extended. I don't think it's not a box office dud. So maybe it makes around 350 mil.
It made 215 mil, which is not far off the 10x for its opening weekend.
Yeah, I mean that's maybe breaking even.
Yeah, maybe.
Once you factor in marketing, which we always have to factor in.
Yeah,
that's soft, man. That's soft for The Patriot. I guess these kinds of movies don't travel. That's what I'm not factoring in, because it's very American. Do the people across the world care about such things? You would have thought the Big Mel factor and the Braveheart factor would be like, oh, never mind, I'm not that fussed about American history, but still, I know what I'm going to get and I'll enjoy it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't translate.
So here's some additional context for opening weekend. While its opening weekend domestic take of $22.4 million was slightly below some aggressive industry predictions, which had it opening at number one, it opened against the hit movie The Perfect Storm. So there you go. That might have been a bit of a troubling issue for opening weekend. Its total revenue, however, demonstrated significant public interest and staying power. It was a hit, as described, that broke the stigma that American Revolutionary War movies are not viable commercially.
It's not a hit. If you spend 100 million and you only make like double your money. That's not a hit, man.
No, I mean, I agree.
I think people would not want to have gone to see a movie about American independence from the director of Independence Day, starring Big Mel. That was 165 mins.
Right.
You know, I just don't. It doesn't have the global legs. Demonstrably does not have the global legs.
Here's a great story from the Tampa Bay Times. 4th of July, 2000, this story was published. Patriot, they say, no match for The Perfect Storm. George Clooney's The Perfect Storm blew Mel Gibson out of the water at the box office over the weekend. The movie, based on the true story of a fishing crew battling a behemoth tempest, took in $41.7 million to debut at number one at the weekend box office, according to studio estimates Sunday. The movie's gross almost doubled that of Mel Gibson's Revolutionary War spectacle, The Patriot, which took half as much Friday to Sunday to finish number two. And the animated adventure Chicken Run, which of course we know featured Mel Gibson's voice as well, was the third highest grossing film of that weekend. There you go. So you add those two together, and Big Mel still isn't as big as Big George. How about that?
I think that's interesting. I think that tells you a lot about what American audiences wanted at the time.
Yeah.
They wanted spectacle, and The Perfect Storm was pure spectacle. A soggy, soggy spectacle. But also, it speaks to it's apolitical.
Yeah.
It's just about men surviving. American men, all played by Americans.
You know what I'm going to say about when it was released?
Just before 9/11.
It was a year before 9/11. I wonder if The Patriot had come out a couple of years later, if it would have captured a different kind of domestic fervour that otherwise just wasn't necessarily there in the year 2000. It was the end of history, after all. America had won.
It's ahead of its time.
I don't know if it's ahead of its time, but I think it was...
Then it was. You're right. It's like 2 years ahead of its time because it doesn't... Like, Americans don't need to be reminded about this. They're like, yeah, of course. Of course. We don't have to... We would take it as a given. And then, you know, a year later, they're like, oh, the Taliban are coming for them. And suddenly then it's like, take up arms. Take up arms, guys. Who's going to come and stand against this nonsense?
Right. You know, the Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle opened that weekend as well. I wonder if that had opened a year later, whether more people would have been interested too. But who's to say?
Good evening, America. Bullwinkle Moose here saying, forgotten the line.
Just tell them to turn off the TV and vote for whoever they want.
Turn off your TV and vote for whoever you want.
And whoever wins the election, replant the forest in Frostbite Falls.
Should we do the bit of the show where we talk about choosing our next week's movie?
Yes, please. It's your turn, isn't it, this week?
It's my turn. You got me. My turn. My time. My term. You got me on The Patriot. Because you had inside knowledge. You listened to my Ticket Stubs episodes. I saw The Patriot at the cinema.
Yeah, you old man. You're old. They wouldn't have let me in to see that kind of brutality back in 2000.
Anyway, you asked a question at the beginning of this episode about Big Willie. Big Willie, Big Will.
Yeah, Big Will Smith.
Because, of course, the director of this film, The Patriot, Roland Emmerich, did indeed direct Independence Day.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, let's begin the game.
Oh my God, are you going to say Independence Day?
Men in Black.
Oh, so it's interesting you say Men in Black. I watched Men in Black, I would say a year or two ago, having not seen it for a very long time. And it was quite a nostalgia-fueled fun fest for me. I particularly was viscerally reminded of the Cockroach Man and sugar water and all of that stuff that I'd completely forgotten. So I think if you'd caught me before I'd rewatched it, I would have said, hell yeah. As it is, hell nah.
But it's a, you know, you're doffing your cap, right?
Yeah, I'm doffing my cap. I think that is a movie you forgot. It's just not one that I forgot in this moment.
Okay. Sticking with this theme.
Are you going to say Wild Wild West?
Never seen
Wild Wild West, no.
Bad Boys.
So, This is interesting. This will be interesting for you. I've never seen Bad Boys. However, I have seen Bad Boys 2 about 10 times because I had it on video. And I don't know why. I remember once starting to watch Bad Boys after I'd seen Bad Boys 2 several times. And after about 15 minutes, I was like, this is shit. Let's just get Bad Boys 2 on. And then I put Bad Boys 2 back on instead. And let me tell you, a credit to the American Hollywood movie industry that makes sequels for people that do not have to have seen the first film. Because Bad Boys 2, it's a delight. I mean, it was when I was a teenager. So can't say yes to Bad Boys.
Okay. Hit three. Enemy of the State.
Never seen it.
Oh, man.
You were hoping for that one. Yeah, you want. I could tell from your voice you wanted that one.
I Am Legend.
I mean, I honestly can't say yes to that. I would love to, because I'd love to talk about it when we've talked about it a lot before. But I've seen it many times. And for me, I think I'll say two things here. For me, it's not a film I forgot. And I would make an argument that it is not a film that one forgot. I think it does have a place in culture. It's not in the canon, but it has a canon-adjacent place, and it comes up in memes enough, and it's like, it's there.
But this speaks to your question. Will Smith, Big Willie's slap, has made all of these films even more forgotten than they are. You could get me on I Am Legend.
Okay, I'll store it up.
Okay, well, so this is my fifth choice. It's got, you know, I'm going to say it, Independence Day.
Okay, you can get me on Independence Day.
So could I have got you on Aladdin?
What, you mean the CGI remake? I mean, I didn't ever watch it. I would never watch that film. I'm not, I want to say for the record, I'm not interested at all in any of the live action Disney remakes. Don't care. Wish they didn't exist. Happy for children to enjoy them. Not interested. Watch the fucking cartoons and piss off. iRobot, you maybe could have got me on. What other Big Willies are there? Because I mean,
that's the thing I'm looking at. There aren't that many Big Willies.
Okay, yeah.
It's a lot of guff, like, you know, The Pursuit of Happiness.
Oh, God.
And like, Concussion and 7 Pounds and Hitch.
Right.
Focus.
Hitch. You could definitely,
Earth.
Definitely get me on Hitch. And I would
watch
that.
I've never seen Hitch.
Oh,
never seen it.
So
I'm
much
never
more watchable
it.
Than Independence Day. So, do you know what? I watched a really weird film the other day. Speaking of Hitch, I watched a film, Here Comes the Boom. Have you ever seen Here Comes the Boom?
With Kevin James. Of course not.
Kevin James, he's in an MMA, mixed martial arts film. That was, here's what I wrote, a lot less silly than I was expecting from The Cell. It's a very American film, I wrote, about personal responsibility, and it goes fairly easy on the American system of government. Its premise is the failing American school system, or its setting at least, where cutbacks mean losing Henry Winkler, or is it Wrinkler? Henry Winkler? Henry Winkler. Wrinkler? Winkler?
Winkler. It's Winkler.
Yeah. Where cutbacks mean losing Henry Winkler's music program. So Kevin James, who is a dejected biology professor and ex-college Division I wrestler, he gets wrapped up in committing to raise the funds to keep the program alive. He becomes an MMA fighter, and eventually he wins a fight in the UFC, raising the money. He also, Adam, wins the girl, as you might expect. School nurse Selma Hayek.
Yeah, she would be a school nurse. Hey, Joe, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, big time.
What did Kevin James say to the sound operator on the set of one of his old movies where he played an MMA fighter?
Oh, I don't know. What did he say to his sound operator in one of his old movies where he played that MMA fighter?
Here comes the boom.